The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
This Ben Jarofsky Show, Benny J. Bonus Interview, is brought to you in part by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local 126 and District 8, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 9, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, and the Chicago Federation of Labor. Benny J., take it away.
Bonus time on the Ben Jarofsky Show as I speak. It's Thursday, January 2nd, 2020. Man, that's taken some practice. 2020 in the year 2020. But of course, you're listening to this anytime. It's a podcast.
It could be the year 2025.
It could be the year 2525.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. Get your head around that one. Yeah. And marijuana is legal, so it'll help you get through it. All right. And my guest, as I always do, I ask my distinguished guest to introduce himself or herself, in this case, himself. Introduce yourself.
Trial lawyer and managing partner of Dwyer and Coogan, Jim Coogan.
And Jim Coogan, as everybody knows, is a regular guest on the Ben Jarofsky Show. We've called this, How Is This Legal? That's the name of the guest. What was that?
Prison bars.
Oh, okay. We should copyright that, Jim. How Is This Legal? with the slamming of the prison bars. Jim, some of these, I have these four names that I want to run past you, or three names, and one of them is new, and two are sort of ongoing themes, represent ongoing themes, and the names are Alex Jones, William Barr, and Michael Horowitz. Each represent a different segment of our legal system, some of the problems and struggles within trying to make sense for a layman to make sense of what is legal and what is not legal. Let's start with Alex Jones before we go to William Barr. It's one of our favorite topics, William Barr and Michael Horowitz, who is the Inspector General for the Justice Department. Let's start with Alex Jones, the notorious talk show host and podcast host. Does he have a podcast? Is it a podcast technically, or is it cable?
A radio show?
Radio show. Alex Jones has been sued by parents of children who were slaughtered in Sandy Hook back in 2012. And that case has been dragging on for quite a while. And I share your mini obsession with this case and the legal issues it raises. And I'll just start by repeating something that you said before we went on mic. I've spent my whole life as a journalist, and I'm very concerned about how bullies use libel law to intimidate journalists into silence. So I'm very cautious about using a libel as a tool to silence dissent and silence legitimate discussion and debate. On the other hand, what Alex Jones did crossed all borders and standards, destroyed all standards of decency, where he said, essentially promoted the view that there was no slaughter at Sandy Hook, that it was made up by the deep state in order to get motivate government into passing laws that would restrict the right to bear arms. That essentially was his argument that he was using. So let's break it down. Talk a little bit about the reaction, the lawsuit itself that the parents filed.
First of all, what a merry way to say Happy New Year than to be talking about InfoWars and Alex Jones.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Alex Jones, he must have gone to the same gibberish school as what's the congressman from Georgia who's been railroading all these debates. I could see his face now with the glasses. Anyway, he's got an amazing ability to just say words and kind of run through crazy conspiracy. They just come off of his tongue as if it's like the most natural thing in the world. So this was a perfect opportunity, one of the most high-profile mass shootings in American history, I mean, at this point. And I don't know if there's a way to compare the level of tragedy of them, but it certainly was something that so many people could be moved by and were moved by. And we've kind of, the sad refrain after every mass shooting since, and after mass shootings in general in this country from a political perspective, is that things end up just going back to normal, that it's never enough to move the meter on whether or not there will be any action from a legislative standpoint. But Jones saw an opportunity here, in my opinion, to capitalize and use something of such a high profile and such wide renown to engage the paranoia of his audience, because every single time there is some kind of news about a shooting or something that might spur any kind of legal action to regulate gun safety in this country, it's used as a tool by him and by others of his ilk to gin up the paranoia, the fear of his followers that they're going to come take our guns. So that's exactly what he did. He turned something that did not seem to anyone else, any rational person, to be debatable or questionable as to whether it happened, whether this is how it happened, whether Adam Lanza was the person who did it, or what weapon he used, or whether these were real people that were involved in this, and created this parallel universe of paranoia and conspiratorial nonsense to... To sell things on his airwaves.
Yeah, and to sell things on his airwaves and make a healthy living with his airwaves. And how did the parents react?
Well, so what ended up, one of the things that happened here is because he was explicitly calling out individual people who had lost, of all things to do, to call out individual people who had lost children and been, you know, as a consequence, either they were interviewed on television during the moments after, or somewhere in the aftermath, or going forward, because they were parents that were supporting the cause of more gun safety laws in this country, or started a foundation or something like that. He mocked their sincerity. Mm-hmm. He questioned whether their children had actually been killed. He posited, or at least, I don't know, speculated that perhaps they were actors, that their children were actors, that none of this was real, that this was all something concocted by a deep state, by a gun control society of some kind, that, you know, some mysterious thing, or even right out in front of you, every gun control group that wants to take guns away is just basically manufacturing an event like this, a trauma like this, where 20 kids are killed to force legislative action. Oh, Doug Collins. That's who I was thinking of earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The congressman from Georgia.
They've got the same like cattle call ability to just rattle off conspiratorial nonsense.
Yeah. As opposed to Stephen King, not the writer, but the, what's the gentleman's name from Iowa?
Steve King.
Yeah. I mixed that. Not the writer, the congressman who makes the most ugly, hideous racial attacks against all kinds of black people, Hispanics, etc. But yeah, these are the different leaders, if you will, of the Republican Party who've really brought the party down, in my humble opinion. All right, so going back to Alex Jones. So he made these assertions on his show very boldly, very confidently, named parents, and the parents responded by filing suit. And what was the nature? Explain to people what type of suits they filed.
So the one where we had a touchstone to speak about the case, this particular show, is like several others, because there is individual parents who have all taken different actions, and not all of them have come forward. Some have remained in anonymity, sought anonymity, and aren't even bothering with trying to sue him over it. But this involved one parent who sued him in Travis County, Texas. That's where he operates, outside of Austin. And the suit was over libel, basically public statements that are untrue that damage his character. Mm-hmm. For this parent.
Now you're a lawyer. Have you ever had a libel case? Have you ever represented a client who is accusing someone of libeling their good name and reputation?
I have. It's not a big part of our practice, but I have been on the plaintiff side of a couple of those cases. Yeah.
And so, what are the difficulties and challenges of a libel case?
Well, first of all, it depends on the profile of the person that you are saying has been defamed. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about this on this show, that there's a big difference between a public person and a private person. And I imagine that's one thing that they haven't even gotten into in these cases yet. This particular guy is Heslin, was the name of this. This particular case had to do with some discovery fines that were levied against Jones, which we'll, I'm sure we'll get to in a second. But the initial challenge is if it's a person who has a public profile, they are going to be naturally subject to a lot more public commentary. So you got, there's a higher bar for whether something that's been said about them actually constitutes slander or libel. Mm-hmm. But if it's a private person, then it's a little bit more straightforward. It's a lot easier to prove that. So that's one of the initial things you're looking at, is what kind of a client is coming in the door and what kind of a public or non-public profile do they have in the first place. But the question is whether, you know, is the thing actually defamatory? There's a difference between opinion versus fact. Whatever the person that you're alleging defamed your client said, you've got to look at it very carefully, and you have to be able to establish that they are stating something that is false about your client, as opposed to saying he's a jerk. Mm-hmm. I think that's mostly an opinion, but you know, and even that can be the subject of litigation within that case. You know, whether, and so important distinction also, most people don't think about this all the time. Slander is a statement, libel is a printed statement. So we're talking about libel, we're talking about publications. That's mm-hmm. another initial step that you're trying to define if you're representing mm-hmm. someone. So if you're talking about a printed statement, then you're talking about presumably a publication of some kind. So then you're looking at, well, where, you know, sourcing information. Where do they get? Are they just printing something that someone else said? Mm-hmm. That, and then did they vet it properly? I mean, these are all questions. Is it just an anonymous thing? That they're, you know, who knows? That's not. I don't know if there's any journalists that ever do that, but just make something up, put quotes around it, and pretend like somebody said it when they really nobody actually did. Mm-hmm. That would be a nefarious way to get around, you know, libel law. But those are kind of the initial things you have to figure out. What's the profile of your client? What's the nature of the statement? And what kind of place was it put in?
Yeah. Well, in this particular case, Jones just made stuff up. I mean, or was repeating stuff that other people made up. I mean, Sandy Hook happened. To say that Sandy Hook happened is like saying, it's worse than saying the man didn't land on the moon. You know what I mean? There's other instances where people have said things that we all accept as reality didn't happen. And then when people say that to you, you have to sort of wonder about their mental stability, where they're coming from. And you could say, you know what, I want to remove myself from conversation with this person because they are too weird for me to deal with. All right. But in the case of Alex Jones, he's a very prominent, powerful person in his little world. He has thousands, if not millions of listeners, people who follow him, buy his products, you know, drive the ratings of his show, make a nice living for him. He's got Donald Trump's ear. Donald Trump has extolled his virtues
explicitly.
Explicitly. It's been on his show. Mm-hmm. His celebrities have been on his show. So he's a very prominent person. And when he gives, when he starts articulating things like Sandy Hook didn't happen, this is all a conspiracy, then that you can't just walk away from that.
Well, and to that point, one of the things that the reactions to this was that he would say, among other things, that, well, this needs to be investigated. Or, I'm sorry, well, this needs to be investigated. And this needs to be investigated. Yeah. And I'm going to investigate that.
Yeah.
What that was interpreted, and I don't know, I try not to listen to too much of his stuff. I don't know if he said to his people, go out and investigate it, but some of them interpret it that way. So you had folks showing up in Sandy Hook who were InfoWars watchers or listeners holding cameras, you know, camera phones and camcorders in people's faces and trying to, like, track their movements and figure out if they were real people and doing investigations.
Quote unquote investigations.
Yes, yeah. Right. The citizen journalism, which is just, you know, offensive nonsense cloaked in some kind of objective search for the truth, which the truth is already so clear that you really don't have to debate it here. But yeah, so it influenced people's perhaps opinions about or what they might have thought about mm-hmm. this particular parent or others. Posner is another one who's had a high profile and, like, actually is trying to, you know, do something about gun safety as a result of his grief. It actually spurred people to real dangerous action.
And so a suit was filed. I can't remember how long ago. I want to say a couple of years ago, but I've lost track of time.
Yeah.
It's 2020
there's
now.
More than one of them, too.
There's more than one of them. And there was a pretty significant ruling that took place about a week ago. Tell folks about that.
So one thing that happens in every civil case, you file suit against a defendant. Once you are at issue, you know, the both sides have some pleadings and so on, then the one of the most important phases of any civil case is called discovery.
Mm-hmm.
So discovery, and particularly when you have an imbalance of not just power, but also substance between two sides. So when one individual is suing an entire corporation, discovery is a really important and powerful tool in that situation. You know, when it's two big companies suing each other, they got all the lawyers and all the money in the world to fight over it. But discovery is even more important in those, or the fact that you have the power to find things out is so much more important when it's just one guy. And in this case, you're talking about a plaintiff suing Jones, but also in the context of his publication company. I don't know if it's called InfoWars, or but that's what they do business as. Mm-hmm. And in particular, trying to find out what did he know? What kind of, you know, vetting process was there? What kind of information did they gather? Who did they interview? What was he basing any of these statements on? I'm sure that's all contained in discovery requests. And what you can, the power that you have as a litigant in a civil case is you have the power to request, with the judge's backing, if he doesn't think you're being unreasonable, I want your documents. I want the internal memos where you discussed where scientists were testing tobacco safety, or I want to see the source documents for what testing you've done on the effect of sugar on children, or in this case, what did InfoWars actually do between December of 2012 and the first time Alex Jones started spouting his conspiratorial nonsense on the airwaves and to his podcast and whatever other formats that it's publicized in.
Mm-hmm.
What did they do? What did they have? What records, what business records do you have? Because we want to know, did you vet any of these things? Was there a serious investigation? Or would it be provable that you knew that this was false?
Mm-hmm. And so the they were not very, Alex Jones was not very responsive to these discovery requests.
As is occasionally the case mm-hmm. in a civil litigation, the defendant being sued did not want to turn over things that they were being asked for. And I mentioned a moment ago, as long as a judge agrees that you're being reasonable in your request and you're within the rules of whether it's federal or state court, this is why people hire lawyers, is to know those specifics of what you can ask for. And then how do you force them to turn it over when they refuse? In this case, the way you force them is you file a motion to compel. And if they cannot come in, there's a phrase in the law called rule to show cause. If the person who's refusing to show things and turn things over can't come into court and explain a darn good reason why they are violating a court order mm-hmm. and a valid discovery request within a civil action, then the judge has the power to say, okay, well, you got to pay for whatever, whether it's attorney time or expenses related to some of the requests. Again, that's really dependent on the specific rules of the jurisdiction you're in. But the point is, here, that fine was as $100,000.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, that's, I don't know how substantial that is in Alex Jones's world, but that's nothing to sneeze at yeah. as far as discovery violation fines go.
So explain this to me then. So the judge ordered that that Jones pay these legal fees for the plaintiff who's suing him because he wasn't responding to discovery. So Jones can appeal that, correct? He can appeal that that ruling and so try to avoid having to pay the legal fees by appealing. But does he also still have to turn over the documents that he's not turned over, or is it a successful way to avoid turning over documents just by paying $100,000?
Well, that depends. So first of all, I mean, this order probably had several deadlines that were violated before it was entered.
Mm-hmm.
So the court can say to him, okay, you have to pay, there were two separate orders, $65,000 and $35,000, and it's another $1,000 a week until you turn this stuff over. So it could be that they just continue to rack it up. Whether that meter runs while you're on appeal, I think is probably subject to specific rules of the jurisdiction. But ultimately, I mean, yes, you're absolutely right that he can take that up on appeal and suspend the ability of the plaintiff to get any of those documents. They call that an interlocutory appeal if they do it, and it suspends the case, because as the plaintiff, as the person who's pursuing the case, you still need that stuff. And you could make a strategic decision and say, well, we'll let that appeal be a parallel action while continuing with what we do have. You know, there are... there's, so just as one small example, there's a different presumption in the civil trial versus a criminal trial when you don't turn something over. In the United States, because of the Fifth Amendment, you have the right to remain silent and you are not compelled to turn things over or to make statements that could implicate you in a crime. But in a civil case, at least, for example, Illinois has this presumption, and virtually all civil jurisdictions do in this country, your failure to produce something can lead to the inference that it's a bad thing for you. The jury's allowed to draw negative inferences by your refusal to turn information over. In other words, the argument could be made, ladies and gentlemen, they didn't turn over any of these emails. So imagine the worst thing that they could have had in there, such as, well, we know these parents are really grieving, but let's screw them anyway. Yeah. You're allowed to draw that inference, ladies and gentlemen. Like, that's something that does happen in civil cases. So sometimes, even after appeals, even after, sometimes documents are still just not turned over. I mean, with a lot of caveats as to the specifics of a given case, but there's at least one other remedy involved in terms of how the outcome is then later decided.
What remedy is that?
The presumption that, okay, you don't want to turn it over, then we can draw these. And, and that came up in the context of the obstruction of justice, obstruction of Congress charges in impeachment, because they explicitly said that.
Yeah.
They made it, and they tried to make it very clear, because, again, this is not something people commonly think about, but that was the whole point is, okay, if the president, if you refuse to turn these things over, we will draw these inferences the same way a civil jury.
Yeah. By the way, we've been doing these interviews so long, you read my mind. That was literally the next thing I was going to say. There are many parallels between what Alex Jones is putting the parents, the Sandy Hook parents through, and what Donald Trump is putting Congress through. There are many parallels. Donald Trump says he does not have to abide by requests for information that Congress is making. He does not have to abide by subpoena that a certain one of his aides testify. He doesn't have to testify. We'll get to this in a little while, but I've been saying this a lot on the show, Jim. I do believe that issue, this issue of how much President Trump has to comply with the request from Congress, will become a case of its own. It will drag on this impeachment matter for a long time, because I think that the Democrats are not just going to roll over and allow him to stipulate what he does and, what he has and what he has to do in this matter. No, I don't want to comply with that. And so just try me without that evidence. And I don't think they're willing to concede that point. And I don't think the Sandy Hook parents are willing to make the same concession to Alex Jones.
Well, yeah. So drawing it back to InfoWars for a second, I think that their purpose in filing this is not just to win a case against Alex Jones, whatever the financial gain might be, whatever that case might be worth. It absolutely is driven by their desire to expose just how craven his enterprise is. Mm-hmm. So getting this information, getting behind the wall of noise of that institution to find out what's really going on, the inner workings, probably, I would presume, unless they're all actually clinically insane, exposing the cynicism that would be baked into all of the inner workings of an operation like InfoWars would be the whole purpose of this. If you're trying to honor the memory of your child and then keep that honor by targeting someone who has defamed you and your child's memory, you'd want to go expose just how the word is craven that operation really is.
And along to that point, there's a deposition of Alex Jones. One of the things he could not prevent was being deposed by one of the attorneys. I can't remember which attorney it is, but if you want to watch it yourself, folks, it was an assignment I gave poor Jim Coogan. I sent it to him and he actually watched it dutifully. Well, I don't know how much of it you watched, but it's a deposition. It says a lot about Alex Jones. He's being deposed by an attorney for one of the parents. if you've ever seen Alex Jones on his show, how bold he is, how defiant he is, how unafraid he is to declare whatever he wants to declare. And then you watch him in deposition, it's a totally different creature. He's uncertain, can't remember. If you say so, he doesn't even speak in the same, barking way. And then there's that moment, he denies things. And this is something, help me out here. You've done probably a lot of cross-examinations and depositions. What good does it do? So a lawyer says to him, did you not go on the air and mock the parents? He goes, no, I did not. And then they go, well, can we play this? And then they play literally a portion of the Alex Jones show where he's mocking he's mocking the parents. Mm-hmm. So he just said, I didn't mock them. Then he said, they show him mocking. What purpose does it serve? I don't understand this, Jim. Help me out here. To deny something that you know that the lawyer has evidence of.
I guess that taking that position must be the final refuge of the damned in that situation. Because, as an initial matter, I was impressed by the beginning of that clip because it was pretty short, actually, at least the one that I was looking at it from mm-hmm. YouTube. The beginning of it had a few questions with a setup, an answer, or a denial, and then a direct piece of evidence to contradict whatever his denial was, showing him mocking the sobbing of people and putting it in some bizarre context of, like, the cameras aren't off, and then they find out the cameras are going to come on, and all of a sudden they turn it on with classically trained actor techniques.
Yes.
And, he uses all this terminology and jargon to make it sound like he knows what he's talking about. I was very impressed that lawyer was clearly very well prepared, had the clips ready to go. And whoever made the video even managed to superimpose like his video of InfoWars next to his face in the deposition. So that was well done. The only thing I may not have done the same way is towards the end of it, when there was a final question where it was really conclusory, like, and isn't it true that you intended to do this and this and this? It was more pieces than I would put into one question. I would have broken it down a little bit more clearly. The reason being, when you get those denials, it's more effective, in my opinion, which I think is a learned opinion, to have them be on very small snippets of information at one time and get several denials that seem preposterous. But besides just being like, I don't know, he had no strategy whatsoever, and his lawyer couldn't come up with anything, yeah. or he has a crazy client who's just going to do whatever he's going to do anyway.
Yeah.
That's just what happens yeah. sometimes. The evidence might be crystal clear, and you've got it up on a board, and the person's saying that's not what we did, and tries to offer either some justification, excuse, or context that this is where it comes down to. If they're never going to settle that case, or if they just won't admit to what they did, then a finder of fact actually has to try the case. This is why juries are a very old human construct, because sometimes you've got people who just will not admit what they did,
yeah.
and the rest of the community's conscience has to sit down, hear both sides, and go, yeah, all 12 of us can hear that yeah. you're absolutely nuts. We see the picture,
yeah.
or we heard 12 other witnesses that saw this thing happen. If you won't deny, if you won't admit it, we don't care. Our verdict is in favor of the other side.
By the way, in defense of Alex Jones, words I thought I'd never come out of my mouth, his explanation was that he was not mocking the parents. A characterization that Jones said the lawyer put on it, that he was merely imitating the parents. But if you see his imitation of the parents, it was not of a person genuinely grieving. It was an exaggerated portrayal of someone pretending to crying, classic crocodile tears, mocking and making fun of. So I don't know how that deposition in any way helps Alex Jones, and I really don't care, actually. But what it does do is drag out the case. And so I have a hunch we'll be coming back to this case, Jim, within the next years. But it's clear that the Sandy Hook parents are not going to give up on this. And Alex Jones is going to have to try to figure out some way to get out of this.
Look, in general, I think that there is, I don't know how successful it's going to be because we live in an age of so much disinformation, but whatever the various ways that people go about trying to fight for honesty and truth and trying to push disinformation peddlers out of business, I think is a good thing for American society. This would be one mechanism. And again, yeah, I mean, I guess he's still in business. I know he's been pushed off of some platforms because of the things that he says and because of the patent dishonesty in some of the ways he reports on things or reports. I'm putting that in air quotes for everybody on a pod, listening to the podcast. But, you know, that phenomenon is not limited just to Jones. It's certainly not limited just to, like, crackpot media folks. I mean, it's pervasive. And, you know, we've had other discussions about the media in which these things exist on YouTube or in Facebook and how this stuff is out there. And it's just corrosive. Guys like him, these kind of peddling in or taking advantage of people's deepest fears, selling them junk that won't actually help them with those fears, or just trying to sell them on being more afraid for his personal profit, but then putting the cost onto the whole community because you got a bunch of disinformed people who are just completely twisted around and don't even know what's happening.
Well, let's move on to the second name on my list that I want to talk to you about. And we've talked about him several times in our interviews, and that would be Attorney General William Barr, who is more or less an ally of Alex Jones, if you view it, as they're all sort of part of the Donald Trump movement. William Barr, there was an interesting essay in the New York Times I urge everybody to read by Caroline Frederickson and Catherine, I don't know the other,
Stewart.
Catherine Stewart. I couldn't read my own writing. Catherine Stewart, I can't remember when it ran Monday, but it was the way it really got at the heart of how William Barr is trying to rewrite what we mean by separation of church and state in our country. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it's a fascinating point. This was really well, I think, contextualized because it brought in, it compared one interpretation of where he's at either now or even if you consider the fact that he was Attorney General under George Bush the first, George H.W. Bush, back in, I think, 1990, or I don't know if he was his first, actually, he might have been his first attorney. No, he was replacing somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So it was in the midst of that term that went from 89 through 93.
Mm-hmm.
That being that he was unabashedly a tool of Republican politics and willing to disregard the norms of the office of the Attorney General in service of whatever political end would benefit the right-wing forces and not the Justice Department, not the government in general, and not the American people in general. Because, you know, back then he basically buried and helped bury the investigation into Iran-Contra that was being conducted by what used to be an inspector or an independent counsel that was investigating what the Reagan administration had done. And then, of course, now, in after being appointed last year, managed to, or 2 years ago, I guess now, I think it was 2018 when he got appointed. By the spring of 2019, he preempted the Mueller report with his own letter that mischaracterized what the thing said in a very short, I mean, give him credit for doing in short sound bites so it would carry across the airwaves and be extremely digestible with no context, no explanation, no facts, conclusions that were surprise self-serving for him and for the for Trump himself.
Mm-hmm.
So one view of William Barr is that he's a political hack. The other view, which has been around for a while as well, is that he is in service of this notion of the unitary executive. It's a generally almost universally right-wing interpretation of the Constitution that says Article 2 gives the president way more powers than most people have, than the general consensus has been giving credit for or allowing him to work within since the founding of the country. That Article 2 really means that the president does not have to be subject to scrutiny, be subject to oversight, cooperate with Congress, or, you know, at best, we'll leave it up to the judiciary. And I don't know, just in case it happens that you've got a majority on the Supreme Court, you could then safely assume that any fight that went to the judiciary is also going to go your way because, at least as it's currently constructed, there's 9 members of that thing and they can break any ties. And as long as there's a partisan vote, you'll never lose.
Mm-hmm.
So this article, I think, very well looked at whether or not, you know, what really drives him. Is it one of those two things? Is he just a hack? Is he just an executive in love with the executive branch? But what they pointed out is these are two mechanisms with which he operates, because his real drive is heavily, heavily conservative Catholic. That he, that what he wants, or what he's driven by and has been writing about, this is no secret. It's not like I'm just making this up. He's written letters, he's written articles about this over the years, is a much more church-centric interpretation of the Constitution and a much more Catholic church-driven United States of America. That the laws should be in service of religion, as opposed to what I personally believe is the correct interpretation of the Establishment Clause of the Constitution, setting forth that the Congress shall make no law establishing a religion, meaning that you're supposed to have separation of church and state. To him, he's twisted that and said, well, the separation means the state can't get in church's way. And that's basically, I think, the upshot of these two authors were putting together.
The state can't get in the church's way, so that means, like in a practical application, that the state can't order a Catholic hospital to give abortions or to give to have doctors counsel women about the right to have abortions. So silence their First Amendment right of a doctor.
Yep. To shut down his religious freedom.
Yes.
And this is the way to thread the needle of, well, how could a guy who's so conservative and so religious also be defending Donald Trump? I mean, you couldn't have a president that was more, I think you could probably come up with examples of violating every single one of the Ten Commandments if you tried hard enough.
Yeah.
Or you wouldn't have to try very hard.
You don't have to try that hard. Yeah.
What would explain that? Why would a guy like that, who's, you know, been a career, you know, legal guy in the Washington community, and this religious zealot, why would he work for Trump?
Yeah,
he doesn't care about Trump.
Yeah,
Trump's a means to an end for him. Trump's a way to get back into the Attorney General's office.
And one could argue it's the same is true for Trump. That Barr is a means to an end for Donald Trump. And we saw this, I don't know if you paid attention to this one, we're leaving the realm of law, moving to the realm of politics, but about a week or so ago, an evangelical magazine published an editorial calling on the Congress to impeach Donald Trump for his various crimes and misdemeanors regarding Ukraine, which we'll get into in a little while.
Christianity Today.
Very good. And there was an uproar from the larger Republican evangelical community, including Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, who was one of the founders, I think, of the publication, saying that editor does not speak for them, and they're with Donald Trump all the way. And then Donald Trump started denouncing the publication and saying, "I've done more for you than anyone else," which is classic Trump.
Yeah.
And so when I see that, Jim, and I think about when
the editor lost his job.
Right. So when I see that, I'm like, well, Donald Trump, who's not in any way religious, doesn't even really pretend to be religious. I don't think he goes to church, has never gone to church, used to be a supporter of abortion rights.
Used to be
a Democrat until he figured out, his bread was butter on this side, different side. Donald Trump is now saying, hey, I'm making it very difficult for women to get abortions in this country. You have to support me in everything else I do, including every war I want to wage, every military budget I want to pass, every lie that I tell about what I'm doing in Ukraine. You have to support me because I'm doing this for you on abortion rights. And so Barr is essentially saying, all right, in addition to that, what? We want you to blow up protection between separation of church and state. So I think it kind of works for both of them.
Well, because Trump has no investment in whether or not there's a proper place for a secular government in America. It doesn't matter to him. I mean, his disregard for Congress is emblematic of his disregard for all of government. Mm-hmm. He just happens to be the president. I mean, it's not like he believes in a competently run administration to try to make people's lives better and try to deal with the fact that we all have rights and we all have to live together in this crazy country. He has no interest in any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. He did see a chance to further his profile. And then when he somehow accidentally won the presidency, he saw a chance to just continue his profile and take a bunch of stuff and just keep grabbing things off the shelves and shoving them in his pocket like he's done all his life. So if he could find a guy who would make that corrupt bargain with him, I mean, there's like nothing. I guess that was the purpose of Bill Barr's wacky denunciation of the Mueller investigation before there was even a report. This was before he even became Attorney General. Remember, he published some 20-page screed about why it was never should have been started. It was, you know, improperly found, no improper foundations for the beginning of the investigation, shouldn't have continued, spying on the president. It was like an application. I will be your partner in darkness. We can once you meet me, you're probably going to be confused because you'll think, well, what's this religious guy want from me?
Yeah.
I never trust those people. And then, you know, as long as they use the right code words and he realizes they're on his side, then they're cool with him. Like Franklin Graham or some of these other lunatics who just, I mean, anything that they're saying in the service of Donald Trump is directly contradictory to the actual teachings of whatever, of their Christian faith. However they square that circle, I don't care. There's no other way to get around that. It's just bottom line.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. It feeds a very this secular notion, if you will. It's like all that matters is the outcome. So
the ends are justified means for both of these
right.
guys. It's pure Machiavellian politics.
And I'm wondering if there will ever come a point when William Barr crosses a line and Donald Trump can tolerate him no more. I can't see that because I think William Barr is smart enough to know how to play Donald Trump.
Of course he does.
Yeah.
He has been playing him. We both laughed at our ability to laud Jeff Sessions either last show or the show before that, because if he actually tried to be, at least in his mind, faithful to the Constitution and his oath of office. Barr isn't going to make that mistake because he had a very direct purpose in mind. Sessions is just like, you know, a good old boy who may or may not have had some trouble if he was trying to run for re-election, but because he was on the Trump train from the start, realized, oh, gee, I couldn't get confirmed as a judge 20 years ago because I was seen as a racist, but I could actually run the Justice Department. Sweet. But he didn't see through quite how cynical Trump really was.
People of my generation can remember Arthur Goldberg, who gave up his Supreme Court seat at LBJ's request to become, UN ambassador to the United Nations because LBJ wanted to put up his crony from Texas, Abe Fortas, on the bench. Okay, so you got to be really old to remember this.
I actually have heard that story, but I did not live through it.
Yeah, okay, it was way before your time. But the point is, that is the ultimate sacrifice that a politician made for a president. Right behind it is Jeff Sessions gave up his Senate seat to be Donald Trump's attorney general, got mocked and maligned by Trump throughout the whole process, eventually either quit or got fired. I'm not quite sure which one it was. And now guess what? He's running for that Senate seat again.
Yeah, he is.
So I actually think that may be more pathetic than Arthur Goldberg when I think about it. All right, we'll be talking a lot about William Barr as time goes on. The third name, Michael Horowitz.
Before we move on, I do want to just put a coda on all that. This is extraordinarily dangerous. I know I've said that so many times, and I know there's like a million other people saying that in this country, but the level of exposure to the flesh and bone of the Constitution right now is so severe. Like, I don't think it could be overstated. Two parties that are willing to twist the meaning of it in the service of those ends in that way is like a threat that the country hasn't faced before.
Yeah, absolutely. Right.
240 years, we haven't had a president who was willing to, who had like literally zero interest in whether there was the integrity of the Constitution. You know, give credit to Nixon. He resigned rather than, you know, put himself through it or because I think, you know, he was a legal guy. Like he understood the value of a legal system that if he really cared about law and order, which he was a manipulation, obviously, but if he really cared about there being a social order in this country, understood that you had to have a constitution and people had to have faith in it for it to work. But this guy doesn't care.
Yeah.
And now he's got a guy who has a whole different agenda that has nothing to do with
absolutely.
The law.
and they're going to work in concert. And one's agenda is to destroy any separation between church and state so that we essentially become a religious state. And the other one is his intention is to destroy any division between Congress and the White House so that the president is an emperor.
Yep.
And that's where we're at. America.
That's what I meant by it is a
dangerous time. I had this discussion earlier today with Miles Konflassen, a journalist, comes in every Thursday. We were talking about climate change, and Miles was pointing out how important and significant an issue this is, and like the fate of our survival. Very gloomy discussion because we have to address certain scientific facts, one of which is there's an impact on our entire environment and our planet by our practices. But then there's the political reality, Jim, that it doesn't seem to be a driving issue. You know, you have all these scientists saying how important it is, but it doesn't permeated to the political discourse, and so
it barely registers. Well, in the polite elite political circles of Washington D.C., it barely registers as an issue that they should talk about on Sunday mornings.
Yeah,
because they're busy both sidesing everything and wasting time on, you know, whatever Trump tweeted that week and having his people on to just spew lies.
Yeah.
Like it's a serious thing. The consequences are, I mean, if anything, you'd think that the business community might start to care because the insurance industry is going to be put out of business by this. How can they continue to insure properties up and down each coast with the intensity of these storms and the rising of the sea levels? So there may be a very unusual political coalition that could come forth at some point and move the needle.
Well, the reality, and that's a whole other conversation for maybe the next time. Waiting for the business community to rise up and defy Donald Trump, you may be waiting a long time.
Look, I mean, they could appeal to him to like change the law first, I guess, would be the better way to save money. But I'm just saying, like, it, you know, somewhere along the way, either certain sectors of the country become uninsurable. Just as one example,
that's
the insurance part of it. Every other sector of society is affected by it.
Absolutely. And I remember, we're on a tangent with a tangent with a tangent, but I remember when the Obamas bought a property on Martha's Vineyard, it was used as a pretext I had this conversation with Miles. I remember having this I get these Tea Party emails all the time, which I love talking about. Somehow I'm on their mailing list. And it was used as a weapon to mock the whole issue of global warming. And they said the Obamas bought this property that's on the ocean in Martha's Vineyard. How can they really believe in global warming? Because they would believe that the water is going to rise up and overcome their property. Clearly, this is evidence that they don't believe in it, and it's just this hoax. This was the argument they would made. And what Miles pointed out is that wealthy people, and the Obamas are wealthy people now, have always had an ability or always have felt they had an ability to ward off nature's encroachment. You know what I'm saying? Just build a fortress that would guard your property from the waves coming over. But that doesn't mean it's not an important issue, you know, but
why that makes them hypocrites is a really, that's because the underlying thread in any story like that is just an abject cynicism.
Yes.
It doesn't matter what the example is of something that Obama did. Like, if he wearing that tan suit clearly means that he doesn't care about racial injustice in this country. Like, it wouldn't matter what the thing is because the cynicism is so pervasive that it is an excuse to write any article or have any opinion on Fox News.
Yeah.
It doesn't even matter how preposterous.
No, it is. Cynicism is the right word. I would say, ultimately, I went to Alex Jones. He's the ultimate cynic.
Sure, the perfect callback to the first part of this show.
Yeah.
That's exactly what he's engaged in. I'm not saying cynicism is exclusive to the right wing of American politics, but it's one of their, it's like a necessary tool because the messages that they're trying to send, the case that they're trying to make really doesn't make any sense unless you have such a deep cynicism and you're just trying to manipulate everyone.
Well, it's definitely not limited to the right. I've written so many articles before I started doing podcasting and radio broadcasting. My exclusive interest was local politics, and I would argue that Rahm Emanuel is one of the most cynical politicians I've ever seen. The way he would rearrange arguments to promote whatever agenda he had. So, like, he was saying he was helping poor people when, in fact, his policies were hurting poor people. I'm going to close these schools so that I can put more money in the schools that are remaining. And the school then 1 year later saying, we have no money, we have to cut nurses. It's
Let me close these clinics because somehow that's going to help poor people in this city.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden there's nowhere for people to go. And that's going to put more of a burden on the infrastructure that did already exist to take care of people who couldn't take care of themselves because they were financially dependent.
So I do. So I do not want anybody to walk away from this thinking that I believe, or Jim believes, that only Republicans are cynical. But this is some serious Republican cynicism, this little game that Barr and Trump are playing. All right, let's go to Mike Horowitz. Michael Horowitz is the Inspector General from the Justice Department. I had an interesting discussion with Attorney Leonard Goodman. I urge everybody to check that out sometime. You can find it on our website. It was about a week or so ago. We did a deep dive with Leonard Goodman. He is more of leftists, I would say. He has a more of a leftist viewpoint on these issues. We were talking about the abuses that Horowitz's report talks about, the whole system of trying to get a warrant from FISA, a FISA warrant to listen on people's conversations, et cetera, and so forth. And we have talked about this at great length, Jim, over the years or months, however long it's been, about as why the case against Donald Trump began in the first place, his alleged collusion with the Russians, no collusion. I said it before Dennis could play it. So you read the accounts of the Horowitz reports. What's your reaction to it?
Well, I guess maybe we should start calling the show, Is This Cynical?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's what Barr was engaged in here as well. I mean, obviously the thread would through any of these things is going to be that he's going to manipulate whatever is coming out of the government to serve the ends of what he needs them to serve. So, you know, Horowitz's investigation was into whether the Justice Department and the FBI were doing their job properly, and whether there were faults with the way that they conducted their investigation into Trump's campaign. I don't know. He seems to be confused about whether he was president at the time they started this investigation based on his maniacal tweets. But he was not president until he got sworn in 2017. And this investigation started, well, it's some of it's 2016, but some of it dates even earlier than that. And I think we actually had talked on a previous show about Carter Page and why he was on the radar of CIA or the FBI, probably both, before he was, at least for a very brief period of time, a foreign policy advisor to Trump's crack team of foreign policy advisors on his campaign. I will say one thing. I listened to the Goodman show that you guys did. I am in agreement with him that there is a serious problem with having secret courts. So, you know, whether or not I believe that this investigation would, that apparently the conclusions of the Inspector General was that it was still valid in spite of some of the problems that were identified. That is a comment on what the law was at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I have long had, I've had a problem with FISA courts since I understood that they were a thing, you know, and I wasn't a lawyer. I think that was brought up in maybe 2004, 2003 in response to 9/11. I think I always thought it was kind of icky, but then realized just how contradictory it is to the precepts of criminal law in this country, that you have a right to know what the government is investigating. You know, so secret courts means secret investigations, and obviously investigations happen without the knowledge of criminal defense all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the things he said was, you can go and get a warrant without telling the defendant that he's being investigated, because otherwise how would you catch anybody doing anything? But you can't just keep on secretly surveilling them ad infinitum. That's the point of having to go to a judge as the neutral arbiter of whether or not this is fair. Mm-hmm. And then the whole court process is also secret. That I have a problem with all of that. But if we're talking about what Horowitz was doing here, the most egregious thing that he identified was that some of the applications for those FISA warrants, which again are to judges that nobody knows who they are and aren't looking at what's happening in there. And unlike regular criminal courts, once that's done, you know, a defense attorney could come in and say this thing was, you know, faulty. You know, they can identify the holes in a warrant when they're trying to exclude evidence in a regular criminal proceeding. That doesn't exist in FISA either. But the worst thing that happened here appears to be, and it actually kind of is a serious thing, one FBI lawyer was actually falsifying information that was being placed into the warrant. So, you know, I think the obvious question that I think is answered in this, although I'll have to confess I didn't read the 400 pages of the report, is would there have been an adequate predicate to investigating Carter Page regardless of that? And remember, the other important thing about this is it's not really a classic criminal investigation. It's an intelligence investigation. Mm-hmm. So whether or not they're not looking into whether somebody committed a crime specifically, although that might be something that they discover. They're also looking into whether, as a counterintelligence operation, is that guy either willfully or unwittingly being used by a foreign government to hurt us? It's a way broader thing. I mean, it's one of the complicated things about foreign policy and the power of the state is, you know, how much power should the CIA really have and all the questionable things, I'm being charitable here, that they've done over the years in the service of what they thought was the America's best interests. But part of the qualification to any of this is they're just looking into whether he's doing things that are costing the United States in the service of, in this case, Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So those were, I mean, obviously that's not okay. The fact that they had lied, basically he falsified information that was being placed in there. But ultimately his recommendation is this just goes to show how much more oversight there has to be in the FISA application process and in the FBI's internal processes. It clearly debunks all of the nonsensical, raving, lunatic conspiracies that Trump and everybody in his camp on down have been peddling since they, whatever, discovered this, that this was a thing. And either before and around the time Comey got fired, because he's been crying about how his wires were tapped and that's not true. Yeah. Obama was not the driver of this. It actually didn't even get to Comey until it had already started. And then he looked at it and said, okay, this should continue. And then eventually brought it to Loretta Lynch's attention. So it was not the key thing here was whether or not this was politically motivated to try to help Hillary Clinton win. And I mean, going back to cynicism,
yes.
Only a true cynic could ever think that whatever Jim Comey was doing in 2016 was going to help Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, he came out and he made a statement right before, a month before the election, that they were going to reopen an investigation because of something found on Anthony Weiner's wife's computer.
Yeah. No, there's so much cynicism in all of this because if we tie everything we've talked about together, just think about what you talked about, unitary executive, the argument that Barr raised going back to the days of George Bush, that the president is essentially all powerful and cannot be investigated. And Donald Trump, he's arguing that his rights, his civil rights and civil liberties were tampered with, violated by this deep state that's threatening our very existence. So he's both playing off like legitimate leftist, and I put myself in this camp, criticism of government overreach into our civil liberties.
Absolutely.
We've seen evidence of years and years and years going. To my first one that popped into my mind, when I really, the whole Black Panther murders of the Black, Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, which was like a profound moment for me to realize, oh my God, there's some serious stuff, violations are, he's using that as a cover to divert attention from an investigation of whether his campaign was complicit with Putin in engineering their campaign to defeat Hillary Clinton. And at the same time, I guarantee you, if push comes to shove, he would be using the FBI and the powers of the presidency in the same way. He may be using now.
How do you know that he's not?
Yes, there you go.
I mean, and that's an identification of the classic, and it's not exclusively Trumpian, but he has mastered it, means of discourse, which is taking a kernel of truth and then tossing it into a tidal wave of self-serving nonsense. I mean, so you have this little idea that, yeah, you know what? We could all be subject to secret FBI surveillance, and I don't like that.
Yeah.
And usually, it's actually right-wing people that don't care, because their attitude is, if you got nothing to hide, what are you so worried about? Right? That's your old school moral majority, silent majority, whatever that thought process is. And a healthy skepticism of your own government is a good thing. I think you should have that anyway.
Yeah.
As an informed citizen, as a person who could, you never know when the FBI could be like knocking on your door because somebody doesn't like you or whatever, or the Chicago Police Department or the Sheriff's Department or Illinois State Police or anybody. But then using that in the service of, like, it's everything. Every time he talks about how he's aggrieved, and yet the guy's been given everything his whole life. I mean, it's all a piece of that mentality of his, which is, I have to confess, it's fascinating to keep watching, even though it's extremely tiresome. But that it's like a perfect meshing. Once he got into politics, that would be, wait, I've been doing this my whole life. I could talk about that this way, that way here, and it's all BS. But it starts with like a little bit, like, yeah, that's really a building, right? I really built a building. It's 40 stories, but I'm going to tell everybody it's 47 stories, which he literally did stuff like that. Like, yes, it's a building, but I'm going to lie about other stuff anyway. Yeah. I mean, it's perfect that this is where his huckster bullshit New York real estate, like, psychology has gone into politics this way.
And it's working very well for him.
He didn't, I don't think he even knew it was direct training for it, apparently.
All right. And so essentially the Horowitz report is being used, or this whole investigation is used to continue the investigation. Barr is calling for this, championing this. The investigation and the investigators. So we're going to have more investigation into what the FBI knew and what it didn't know when it launched this investigation into what Donald Trump's campaign and Russia, etc.
Which then the purpose is to continue to talk. I'm doing that paper thing that you learned from
Larry Luchak. Very good.
It's a perfect thing to drag all the way into next November.
Yes. Well, okay. Yes, it's a perfect thing to discredit the investigations into him to drag that into November. But, and this is where we tie it all together, I think the impeachment will be dragged into November as well. And it's just so interesting. Donald Trump is advocating for unlimited investigation into what the FBI was up to.
In an election that he won.
The election that he, quote unquote, won, because he actually lost the popular vote. But
it's over. He got
to be the president. All right. So let's continue that investigation. At the same time, he is resisting any attempt to have a coherent investigation into what he did with Ukraine.
In a very straightforward, prescribed impeachment process that isn't, you know, does not have any of these faults, or, you know, the even the civil liberty questions, none of this applies to a president, right? Like, you don't even have to have a skepticism about the legitimacy of the investigators there. All the evidence is right in front of everybody. It's not even a question of, like, well, did Adam Schiff really have the right to see the it's not a transcript, the summary of the call.
Yeah.
He released it publicly when he found out that he got his hand caught in the cookie jar. Like, they released the funds when they had the notion that there was a whistleblower. Yeah. Like, literally, within hours of the whistleblower being knowledge coming to the White House, the funds were released.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, there isn't any question about the facts of that case, or whether using power that way is clearly an abuse of the president's ability to use his powers.
All right. So let's close this interview by bringing out your crystal ball for 2020 on the impeachment matter. And this is the issue is, how far will the Democrats push Trump on the issue of forcing aides to testify, releasing documents that are pertinent to the investigation? Will they allow the matter to be adjudicated in the Senate without these documents, without this testimony? Or will they take it, Trump, to the mat, and just fight it throughout 2020 to force him to testify? What do you think?
Well, what you pointed out a minute ago is in line with your argument over the last at least couple months that Democrats, House Democrats, to the extent that they have power over this, should continue to investigate and drag out impeachment as long as possible as a political process.
Yes.
Because there's, in agreement with that.
It's a David Ferris thing. Let's give Professor Ferris credit. Yeah.
And I think you've endorsed that wholeheartedly.
Yeah, wholeheartedly. I've championed it. Yeah.
But, you know, in fairness to that argument, there's nothing obligatory in the Constitution about when that those articles have to be delivered to the Senate. There's no time frames built into it. And we are in very uncharted territory. We've only had two Senate trials in American history. You know, that's all we've got to work with.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like no precedent you can really take from the 1800s. I think that's, everybody would just universally agree with that. And the Clinton process was so different politically, but even with the man himself, like obviously it was improper for him to lie about something under oath in a deposition, but he was still going to follow the law, generally speaking, beyond that. And if he had been voted to be removed, he would have left. I don't think Trump would even do that. I don't know how that would happen. Like, does some sergeant in arms have to literally arrest him? But I don't think he would even honor that if it happened, which is where we get back to the dangerous territory of this guy. So I am on board with the notion that whether or not they wait to deliver these articles of impeachment and then, you know, contextualize that in the dispute over whether witnesses have to testify, because now you're caught in this dumb Trumpian thing about you don't get a do-over. It's not a do-over. These are witnesses that weren't, you know, like allowed to testify.
Yeah.
Or saying, well, you didn't even have these witnesses in your first investigation. Like, yeah, that's why we charged them with obstruction in Congress, because they blanketly refused without any qualification or assertion of privilege to provide any of this stuff.
Yeah.
Not a single document, not a single witness was voluntarily turned over by the White House. That's obstruction of Congress, because they have a legitimate oversight authority. That is undisputed about from people who actually care about government, right? So I don't know if they just continue that dispute over shall Mick Mulvaney testify, shall the guy, I forget his name, Barry, maybe, the aide that actually like wrote the email about what are we going to do with this, and this should be held in the strictest of confidence and so on, and then they actually like release the stuff. Like, that's clear evidence of guilt in any normal situation. Whether they do it in the context of that, or they also continue some other impeachment investigations for all of 2020 into other matters. The political point I'll make is, if they're worried about whether Doug Collins or anybody else from Congress or Kellyanne Conway or the president himself are going to scream and howl and cry about due process and a do-nothing Congress, I've got news for them. And I think Nancy Pelosi knows this. I suspect that she does, because she's extremely politically sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to do it anyway.
Absolutely.
They could sit there and they could actually hand Trump like a golden key and say, well, you know, we don't really want to be too tough on you, so can you just say a couple things and we'll let it go? You will hear screams and howls about this being the most corrupt and unfair process in the history of the United States, no matter what. So at this point, which I think they have done. I mean, they've gone through impeachment. I think they're learning. Democrats are learning to fight a little harder and like actually fight instead of being capitulatists, if that's a word, capitulating all the time. They need to ignore and not be governed by whatever the reaction is going to be from the other side. Here's my suggestion. Act like a plaintiff's trial lawyer. You know what happens every time I ask for anything, any witness I ask for? Coogan, what are you doing? What do you even want? I mean, I had a trial. We talked about it briefly on this show. Big trial, difficult trial, 15 witnesses plus, whatever. It was a medical malpractice case. Somebody died. So right before trial, I went to go take a deposition of a doctor who had been involved in the care of that person when they were dying. Basically, they were discharged from one hospital. Things fell apart overnight. They get taken to another hospital, and the doctor who sees her then is one of the people there. So therefore, he's got a foundation to talk about her actual cause of death, right? It's a limited issue in the case because nobody's disputing that it happened, but I'm still trying to like put a full puzzle in front of the jury with all the pieces and not leave something out.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting there with a guy who's probably tried 25 cases if I've tried one. He's in his 60s or something like that. Sitting there in the deposition saying, you know, what's the point of this deposition? Why are you even taking this? Is taking his testimony so I could use it as in a video at trial.
Yeah.
That jury ended up putting a lot of weight on the manner in which she died.
Yeah.
So, you know, he might have known that that would happen or suspected it was possible, but he's pretending like it's irrelevant.
Right.
Or he really thought it was a stupid strategy and doesn't think I know what I'm doing. Whatever it is, that's my point. I looked at him respectfully. I actually like the guy, but I'm in my head, I'm thinking, I don't care what you're saying right now. Just you're just trying to interrupt me while I'm looking at my notes.
Right.
You know, just do what you got to do. And if your reaction is like, oh, geez, what's Trump going to say? Or what's he going to do to the people in conservative districts that he won, you know,
like
in 2016?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
What's he going to do to them?
Mm-hmm.
They got to disregard it. That is just noise. It doesn't, because his screaming and his yelling and his engagement of his base will be 2,000% no matter what he has to do to get it.
Well, there are two issues that embedded in what you're saying. We'll close, and I'll close by saying this. One is a political issue. And I think the Democrats have to realize that bipartisanship in the 21st century is a myth.
And it's a punch in the face coming across.
It's a punch in the face. Yep. So you gotta let it go. You gotta let it go until the other side shows that they're willing to be bipartisan. And then there's the legal issue. And I don't believe anybody who believes in separation of powers would want to allow Trump to get away with what he's getting away with. Bill Clinton had to testify under oath in a deposition, and he did, and it led to his impeachment eventually. He had to present evidence, and so you cannot, if you believe in a separation of power, allow Donald Trump to get away with this.
And you need, in contradiction of what William Barr is doing, each of them, anybody, even if there is a Republican out there who still cares about the Constitution, cannot concede their false interpretation of what it means. Got to hold on tight to what it actually means. Like, that's their obligation at this point. They're not elected to this Congress. They weren't elected to do anything else, in my opinion.
Well, we'll see which one falls first, their dedication to the Constitution or their fear of Donald Trump. I'm not quite sure where I am on that one. Jim Coogan, thanks so much.
And Jim, I may be mistaken, but did you drop your first curse word ever?
Yes, he did. he let his freak flag fly.
Yeah.
It's after hours. It's after 5 o'clock, so I think
that's all right. It's a podcast. It's
that was like awesome.
We've had people said much worse on this show.
Oh, wait, Ben, hold on. Let's set it up here. You got to ask the question again about the segment. Remember, is this legal? Remember? Go.
Oh.
Is this legal?
Oh, is this legal with Jim Coogan? All right.
Yeah.
There's the setup.
Say another curse word, Jim. Come on.
No, don't. That would not be illegal.
Okay.
Jim Coogan is my guest. And that concludes another great Ben Jarofsky bonus show. Take care, everybody.